Sports Desk, your 950 KJR Sports Headlines.
Yeah, buddy, here we go. Headlines on a Friday afternoon right here on 950 KJR, brought to you by our friends at VenueKings.com.
If Florio thinks we're a couple of buttholes, then he's the dingleberry just hanging around.
Need tickets for the Kraken and Canucks next Saturday. Not tomorrow, that'd be this Saturday. You get the difference, right?
I do.
Next Saturday at Climate Pledge Arena, VenueKings.com. Get you in the door. Be sure and use code Softy at checkout for a little discount. Big news from the Hawks. Russell Wilson going on the injured reserve. That means he's out for at least three games. Chris Carson, though, is joining him, which means neither your starting running back or starting quarterback will be able to play until the Packer game. How about that?
That's usually not a good thing, Dave.
That's not good news there, Dick.
Both Breanna Stewart and Jewel Lloyd, this is good news. They were named first team All-WNBA today. It was Stewart's third time on the All-WNBA list, second time for Lloyd, although the first time she's ever made the first team.
College football. We got two games going on right now. Marshall leads North Texas after 114-0 in Clemson. Man, Clemson sucks. What happened to Clemson? Holy crap. They lead Syracuse 7-0 mid-second quarter from the Carrier Dome. California, Oregon at 7-30. From Eugene, San Diego State, and San Jose State at 7:30.
They're already looking to buy out Dabo's contract over there in Clemson.
I doubt that.
Our friend, former Bellevue star Miles Jack, will not travel to London with the Jags. He is dealing with a back injury.
And what else? Baseball. Dodgers beat the Giants 2-1 last night in the NLDS. Dodgers Braves starting in Game 1 of the NLCS tomorrow. Game 1 of the ALCS is tonight. Boston at Houston. Chris Sale versus Framber Valdez. All right, coming up at 6:05 tonight, Tony Castricone will join us on the radio show, talk some dogs. Philip Grubauer will join us and talk some Kraken.
Release the Kraken.
At 6:30, your goaltender coming up on the program, Lee Sterling's picks for the week at 6:45. But joining us right now on the radio program, the most intelligent man I have ever met in my life.
Is that
my
right?
Friend, Hugh Millen, with us on the radio show. How are you, pal?
You got to get out. You gotta find more friends.
Find more friends for sure.
Find a guy over at the lake, you know, feeding the ducks, playing with a slinky. You know, he'll be smarter than me in all likelihood.
Yeah. Let's start at the top with the big news. I want to talk about Geno, Ben Roethlisberger, everything happening on Sunday, but Chris Carson's on the IR. He's out for three games. Russell Wilson's out for three games. And both of us, Dick and I, we talked about this at the top of the show. And, man, it just kind of feels like maybe it's time to start thinking about moving on from Chris Carson. He just cannot stay healthy.
Yeah, I don't know how many times you have to be disappointed in him, but this is right in a real critical time, obviously, with the season, your record, the NFC West, the state, the fact you don't have Russell. You'd like nothing more than to have a good, capable running game to lean on, and for Carson not to be there, your heart goes out to him. I mean, if he ran like Sean Alexander, I would be really disgusted as a Seahawk fan. Like, really, dude, you're tapping out on all these runs, and you still get hurt, but Carson, he brings such a physicality, such a desire. In that regard, it's obviously reminiscent of Marshawn Lynch. And so it's just the cost of doing business. You're going to get injured. Most guys who are that aggressive and that tenacious in their running style, they're gonna take some licks, and he's taking them.
Hugh, I assumed that Pete was going to go full Pete Carroll this week had he had Chris Carson healthy. Now he doesn't have Chris Carson healthy. So can he go full Pete? Or do you think he's going to be more balanced and put more of this load on Geno Smith to win the game?
Well, I think that for Geno, I mean, that's one of my three keys for Geno is would be the play selection. And a lot of times you say, well, the best friend for a quarterback is a running game. And that's certainly true, a capable running game. I mean, I'd rather hand it off to a guy on first and 10 and have him get 7 yards than have him get 1 yard, right? But in looking at, Shane Waldron, who's going to be calling the plays, look at his background. He played at Tufts University. He was a tight end and long snapper, not a quarterback. I think that you got Austin Davis. He's the quarterback voice in the staff room. Here's what I'm driving at. I think most quarterbacks would agree with me. If you're going to play me, I'm a backup. Let me on half of the first and tens, let me throw the ball. Because if you think you're helping me by running on first down, running on second down, and then now it's 3rd and 7, and they put in their dime defense, they know we're throwing, in a situation, even if you go 50% third down conversions, you're leading the league. You just have me try and convert third downs. That's not my friend. let me throw on some neutral downs, first and 10, second and 1-6, so that I can get into a rhythm. So let's see what they do from a play calling standpoint. Let's not get too conservative thinking, oh, you've got to protect the backup quarterback. No, he's a backup quarterback. He's a professional quarterback. He's been a starter. He's there for a reason. Let him throw the damn ball on neutral downs.
All right. So then nothing really changes then for Geno Smith. If the game plan is the game plan and go out there and execute the damn game plan. If you were to talk to Geno Smith, who's starting his first game, what, 6 years? On Sunday. Yeah. What would your advice be for him? What would keys be for Geno Smith to not muck this whole thing up?
Well, first of all, I tip my hat to how he played, particularly on that 98-yarder. I mean, he came in. Now, that was really vanilla looks by the Rams. It was almost, other than two plays, which were cover three, he had a four-deep defense, three under, just a four-man rush, no stunts, no blitzes, what have you. So real simple in terms of processing to get through the protection phase of your processing into the read the defense and throw to the right guy at the right time phase. And now with Pittsburgh, they've traditionally been a 3-4 team. They play a lot of 3-4, which means that they can blitz one of their four linebackers and it's still just a four-man rush. So you got to find out which guy's coming. Then if they want to bring pressure and bring five, they're bringing not one but two linebackers because they're 3-4. Now this year, they're 27th in terms of blitz propensity. That's low for them in their past. But just a year ago, they were 48% blitzing on first and second down. That was far and away number one in the league by 6 percentage points. So we know that Tomlin and their cohorts on that staff, they have the ability to crank it up. It's in their DNA to blitz, and it's more difficult, again, to process that in the 3-4. So my first suggestion to Geno Smith was make sure that you're up to date. Don't just assume that they're going to blitz 17% because that's their tendencies this year. Be ready for them coming out of that 3-4 to try and confuse you with a lot of different pressures.
They've had some extra time to work on this defense, Hugh, and they're taking on one of the few quarterbacks in the NFL that has cement shoes. I mean, you do not have to worry about Ben taking off and beating you with his legs. So do you think we will see a significant stylistic change in the Seattle defense? And if so, what will it be?
Well, I think forget the style. When they play zone defense, they've just got to play sound defense. They are really giving up those deep intermediate routes, the way the zone structure of the pass concepts that were used by the Vikings were repeated by the Rams. They should have gone to school on this. They've had 10 days, and they've got to clean up their zone coverage. And now, in Ben Roethlisberger, we've got a guy that is at his time to throw average is 2.31. That's number one in the NFL. He's getting rid of the ball. He's third to last in play action percentage. So he's just grabbing the ball from shotgun and showing it and throwing it short. Short? How short? Well, he's 31st in the NFL in terms of average depth of target from the line of scrimmage at 7.2 yards.
Wow.
But let me emphasize, this is a point that I've made seldom in my years at KJR, but I think it's a very important point while we're talking about time to throw. You think of a porous offensive line like Pittsburgh has and like Seattle's had, and you say, well, you associate, well, okay, I don't have time to throw, so I'm going to throw the quick game, hitches, slants, what have you. And then you think, well, the deeper you throw it, the more time you need. That is not my opinion at all, and I think I could convince anybody. When you throw a deep ball, in fact, they hit a on the first drive of the game last week against Denver, they hit a touchdown. Who was it? It was not Claypool.
Johnson?
Yeah, I think it was Deontay Johnson. That's exactly who it was, up the right side. This is my point. For Ben, if they have a bad offensive line, he's going to throw the quick game. But it's the intermediate throws, not the deep throws, that you need the most time to throw. Because a go route, you can go 1, 2, 3. You don't even have to hitch, and you can throw that. You can get up a go route, which is obviously the deepest type of throw, or even a post route, and go 3 and a hitch from shotgun. And you can throw deeper routes because of the loft on the football.
Yep.
The patterns that actually require the most protection are those deep intermediate routes, the angle crosses, and what West Coast people call the dagger, the 18-yard in route or the 18-yard comeback. Those take the most time, not the bombs.
Hugh Millen with us, and I want to ask you about a national topic in a second, but I do want to throw you a little curveball because I know you can handle it, and I think all of us know where you're coming from on Jamal Adams. You're not confused, right, by his take on Jamal Adams?
No, I'm pretty clear how he feels.
Curtis, you know what Hugh thinks about Jamal Adams? I think the entire country knows what Hugh Millen thinks about giving Jamal Adams that contract, but he got the contract. Right? It is what it is.
So we got to live with it.
He's here. You have to live with it. So to get Jamal Adams going, if you were trying to make chicken salad out of chicken crap, what would you do with Jamal Adams if you were Ken Norton Jr. starting this weekend to try and get something out of him?
Well, I would play him a lot like a linebacker. First of all, I think as a back half post safety, I mean, that's Quandre Diggs' job when they play single high. As a cover two safety, that's not his game. You saw him make a really poor play on the ball. I would have him close to the line of scrimmage and really look, if you line him up and he has to defend the A gap or the B gap in the run game, and he has to defend the hook zone, meaning the middle shallow zones in the passing game, well, you're a linebacker. I don't care. You know, you put whatever number you're on, I'd call you whatever position you are. I think that having him in there, you know, there's teams that are successful with smallish linebackers. I'd play him down in the box and let him take advantage of what his best asset is. He's good at read and recognition. He's good at sifting through traffic and in pursuit. And he's a relatively sure tackler for the most part. I the whole idea of blitz him. Well, we could burn up a whole nother segment. I think he's overrated as a blitzer. As I said, 6 of his 9.5 sacks last year, he was totally unblocked. And how they set the table for him, meaning who else they blitz, Bobby Wagner, KJ Wright, how he was able to draft off that. And it was a scheme blitz, not, you know, he had two impressive blitzes in my mind. At Buffalo, he absolutely worked the tight end early in the down, got a sack. And then against the Giants, he ran over their running back like he was a traffic cone. Those were the really two like big time plays of his sacks. That's it. That's 2 out of 9.5. So I think he's an overrated blitzer. But at his best, you take the entirety of his career, at his best, he has been a box player that is quick to recognition and gets to the football wheel, sifts through practice, through the pileups, and is a sure tackler when he gets to the football.
Would it behoove them to play some more single high safety and just let Quandre roam out there and have Jamal up towards the line of scrimmage? Can their corners handle that?
Well, that's the big question, and they do that a lot. I mean, that's essentially their base defense is the single high with Jamal down in the box, and the corner issue has been, you know, their death knell. You think of in baseball, they say, you know, be solid up the middle. You know, your shortstop, your second, your center fielder. I've always wondered, well, okay, doesn't it help to have good defense on the corners too? I mean, that's not my field of expertise. I think in football, you look at where is the money distributed. The distribution of the money, and it's been this way for decades, is corners make much more than safeties, and defensive ends make much more than defensive tackles. And, you know, middle linebackers make less than outside linebackers. You could make the argument that the NFL has spoken and has spoken for many years that it's not through the middle that you pay your players. It's on the edge at every level, at the first, second, and third level of the defense. So, you know, Seattle is where they are. They went to Saks Fifth Avenue for their safety and their middle linebacker, and they went to Walmart for their corners. And so that's going to put them in a bind schematically.
Yeah.
You know, we may see the rookie out there, Trey Brown, Sunday, and if you're going to play, that's the paradox of this team. We haven't even talked about the five down and the defenses you need to play when you go five down. Because when you go five down front to stop the run on a pass play, you should rush all five. Because if you drop off, then you've got contain issues on quarterbacks, all kinds of things. So that point notwithstanding, you still have the issue that you're the highest paid safety in the history of football is a box safety.
Yep.
But your corners can't handle single safety as you'd want Adams to be down in the box. So we'll see how this plays out. Right now, they are a team that's coming off of 4 straight games where they've given up 450 yards or more, and that is not only a Seahawk record, that is the first time since the merger. The merger was 50 years ago.
Hmm. Well, I'm looking at one number that PFF tracks rush percentage snaps. That's the percentage of pass rush snaps per passing snap played. How many times is a guy rushing the passer on a passing snap? Yep. Last year, Jamal Adams was at 19%. Now he's
number
at
one
not, now he's at 9% after five games. So they have dropped that dramatically. So we'll see what they do on Sunday night. Hugh, I do want to ask you, because about a week ago right now is when the story about the official email that the NFL uncovered with John Gruden going after DeMaurice Smith. And then Tony Dungy went on Sunday Night Football and actually defended him on Sunday night. And the next day, he had to resign. I don't think we've even heard your take on the whole John Gruden thing. Mike Holmgren was on with us yesterday, and he worked with the guy. And he's been talking to John Gruden over text in the last couple of days. This is unbelievable, man, this fall for this guy.
Yeah, a week ago, we were trying to decipher and ascribe some level of racism, if there was, to that initial email. And you know, my thought is real simple. Condemn, attack real racism, and reject fake racism. I mean, not everything that is unfortunate that happens to a black person or involves a black person is racism. So how do we look through this? Well, it's like Goldilocks and the porridge. Not too hot, not too cold. You look and you just say, you don't want to be that naive person as a white person and say, you know what? That's clearly racism. It's right in front of my nose. It's freaking racism. It needs to be universally condemned. But by the same token, you don't want to just be knee-jerk and say everything that happens, well, that has to have a racial motivation. And that's exactly what Tony Dungy was telling us. So a week ago, the email said, Gruden said, dumb Boris Smith. Okay, he bastardized his name to put the word dumb in there. If it was Daniel Smith and he's a white guy, could have he said Dumble Smith? Yeah, he could have. So not necessarily is that racism. The whole thing about the Michelin lips. Okay, now you're going, wait a minute, dude. And the best thing I could say for you is that you are totally tone deaf, totally racially insensitive. But you could convince me, like the way we say Pinocchio in the nose, you could convince me that if he had a lifetime of saying, hey, and this is what he said, hey, I use the word rubber lips to you to mean a liar. You could have possibly convinced me that that was just something that he, a slur that he uses towards liars. Having said all that, once we saw from Monday, there's just no defense. There's no defense. And, you know, I'm good friends with Sean McDonough, his former broadcasting partner on Monday Night Football. We've been good friends for years. I texted him before I even heard he got fired. I said, you're going to see John Gruden in exile. I'm talking about Patmos exile for this. And that's a New Testament reference, Dave, for you. There's always room for on our team. So come on.
Old Testament.
Well, not Patmos, but at any rate.
You know why?
So, this kid doesn't look Jewish.
That's why.
I think that, yeah, exactly. what I'm saying is Tony Dungy and Mike Tirico tried to say, hey, this isn't necessarily racism. Let's have some grace. And, you know, I'm trying to, and it's harder for white guys, but I'm trying to say, hey, wait a minute. Does he really use that term, rubber lips, for a liar? Monday, there's absolutely nothing. You know what?
Yeah, forget it.
I think there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of good in the worst of us, and there's a lot of bad in the best of us. And I think there's a lot of people out there that are holding their breath that their emails don't get released.
I mean, either way, it's a PR nightmare for the NFL. Either A, they take crap for not releasing the emails, mm-hmm. right? Or B, they release them, and there's a bunch of crap in there that nobody wanted anybody to
see. Firestorm.
So either way, it's horrible. But hey, do me a favor. You want to hang on? Do one more segment. You cool with that? All right. Hugh Millen's going to rejoin us. Coming up next, there's some big news, by the way, breaking from the Arizona Cardinal camp. Cliff Kingsbury has COVID and is not going to coach in the Arizona Cardinal Brown game this Sunday. So he's out for that game. Chris Carson is on the IR for 3 weeks. He won't play until the Packer game. Russell's on the IR for 3 weeks. He won't play until the Packer game. It's all good stuff, baby.
41 yards.
And we're going to talk about all of it. Get some dog talk as well with Huey coming up on 950 KJ.
Now back to Football Friday, powered by Bud Light on your home for the Huskies and the 12th man, Seattle Sports Radio 950. KJR.
All right, get some dog talk out of the way in a matter of seconds here. Hugh Millen with us. A little Stats Are for Losers, a little DPI coming up 5:45 tonight.
Stats Are for Losers.
On the program. But hey, Hugh, briefly before we get to the Husky chatter, we mentioned the Steelers offense. A lot of talk about Ben Roethlisberger. You mentioned Geno Smith on the Hawks side. We did not get to talk about Cameron Hayward, the defensive tackle for the Steelers. He's had a couple of good years, actually had some great years between 17 and 2019, kind of falling off the face of the earth a bit. How big of a concern is he on Sunday?
Well, yeah, you think about TJ Watt, you know, over there in that matchup with him on Seattle's right side, but and he's been on the right side, by the way, TJ Watt, all but a dozen snaps. So that's going to be a challenge there for Brandon Schell. But in Cameron Hayward, you've got a guy, no, he doesn't have as many sacks, but he has four times as many hurries as TJ Watt. He's playing, he's balling out. You know, in some metrics, he's rated higher than Aaron Donald this year. So he mainly lines up on the right side, on the inside. So for Damian Lewis, who was a right guard last year, just kind of getting acclimated and right guard at LSU, for him now to be on the left side, all the challenge about his balance, his handwork and everything from the left side is going to be put to work against Cameron Hayward.
Hugh, I want to give the keys to the Washington Husky offense to you right now, because I don't understand why Dylan Morris is throwing the ball. What did you say, per game, Dave? Second most in the league? Or
tied for third.
Tied for third most in the league. This is not Hugh Millen. This is not Chris Chandler. This is not Marcus Tuiasosopo. This is Dylan Morris, and he's thrown it third most times in the Pac-12. How do you fix this Husky offense, and what would your balance look like?
Well, I think that to run the football better, I think that they need to run outside better. I think they need to have the outside zone. You know, so much of what they've done has been that inside zone between the tackles. And if you're not making the defense have to flow to the outside zone, and basically they're similar, inside and outside zone are similar in terms of your steps. But if I'm a lineman in the outside zone and I'm blocking you, I'm trying to reach you. I'm trying to almost get my body between you and the sideline. And then now the whoever the running back is, and maybe it's McGrew because of the speed, you know, he's pressing the outside. But if the hook blocks don't take place like I just described, then he can cut it up field. I mean, I was in those meetings with Alex Smith, the godfather of the outside zone, when I was with the Broncos, and I handed Terrell Davis his very first career rushing attempt. And, you know, so I've got these vivid images about the benefits of the outside zone. Alex Gibbs would say we could run the outside zone, and that may be our only running play of the entire year, because it can be one of many plays. It doesn't have to get to the outside. It can bounce. It can bang, mean at the hole, or it can bend. It can bend back inside. There's a myriad of different holes. Seattle or the Husky don't do enough of that. They don't put enough window dressing and kind of eye candy in terms of fake reverses and mixing up the looks and trying to get young, you know, 20-year-olds on their heels a little bit by the looks, and then the RPOs, you know, put defenders in conflict. And now they do that, but I think they can do more of that. So I think it starts with the running game.
And then for
Morris's play, look, Morris, you know, at 6 feet, some of the trouble that he has is that he doesn't see the defender out in front. And so if you put him on the move, meaning a bootleg, not sprint out, but bootleg, but not a naked bootleg, because the end will come up the field. If you have a tight end over there to seal the edge, you can do that from shotgun or from under center. I think that having bootlegs, but with a extra receiver as an edge sealer, does that make sense? So if you're going to fake the outside zone to Sean McGrew, we're going to get that thing going. Then we're going to, with a right-hand cornerback, we're going to come out on the boot right. But we're going to have that. We're going to have somebody, either the guard or a tight end, somebody in place to block the end, so that we can get Dylan really out to the perimeter and you know, get him where he can see a little bit.
The three B's: bounce, bang, and bend. Remember all like those, it. All right?
I'm going to watch for that.
And the bootleg is the fourth right
I hope
there.
Donovan's listened to this segment right now.
I'm sure he is. I'm sure John Donovan woke up today. So you know what? Hugh Mellon's going to be on Softy and Dick at 5 o'clock. I should tune in at 5 o'clock to hear what the hell he thinks. So Tim Brando
was...
It's
so easy to solve all these problems.
Tim Brando was with us about an hour ago and was talking about... He's doing the game tomorrow with Spencer Tillman for Fox. And he was talking about the challenges of the portal and the name, image, and likeness. And I wonder your opinion. I mean, we're about, you know, what, just a few months into this NIL thing. Jen Cohen was on our pregame show like 2 weeks ago, basically asking local businesses to start signing up athletes. You know, anything that was taboo is now on the table. It's crazy how this has changed from when you played, for God's sakes. And the transfer portal is a real thing. I mean, look at all these schools out there that are just getting 10, 15 transfers a year. Now that you're starting to soak it all up, what do you make of this new era in college football?
Well, I think as Brando talks about the NIL and the transfer portal, I think there's two totally separate topics, obviously, but in terms of their effect. And I'm influenced by my experience as an NFL player rep. We went through the strike in 87 and trying to get free agency that these guys now have. And the owners said, hey, the product we are selling is the entertainment value of two competitively matched teams. If we have free agency, everybody's going to flock to the Raiders and the Cowboys. Nobody's going to go to the Packers, and we're going to lose our competitive balance, and we're not going to have the product. Well, that was proven absurd when Reggie White went to Green Bay and they won a Super Bowl, right? But if you still stick with that, now apply that to the college game. So much, you know, we always rip the NCAA, and the NCAA has their problems. But by and large, a lot of the criticisms that that we have as fans about the NCAA, that's just the member institutions determining how they want to govern themselves. And I've always said that in my mind, I have this image. Somehow the NCAA has got to do what they can so that Oregon State has a chance to beat USC. USC has all of these built-in advantages. And somehow we've got to make sure that on some level it can be competitive when Oregon State plays SC. You know, and we're talking about a year that obviously Oregon State throttled SC. What I think is going to happen with the portal, we're going to look back and say it created parity. It created this because you're going to have a lot of guys, these highly recruited athletes, they're going to go to the Oregons and the USCs and the Alabamas and what have you. They're going to take two bites at the apple. They're going to say, hey, I think I'm good enough to start for Bama. Let's just use an illustration. Mm-hmm. But if I'm not, then I can just pull out, go in the portal, and Alabama, depending, I've tried to read to add to this content. You know, I've read 11, I've read 13, I've read 8. But anyway, Alabama's had a lot of guys transfer out of there. And I think the top schools will have these, they'll get the high recruits, but you're more likely to see the high recruits say, okay, let me transfer down. Let me go to a lesser school or maybe even go to the Mountain West or what have you. And so you're going to see more parity throughout college football. Now, the NIL, I think, is the opposite. I think that's going to be, you know, the rich get richer. And so you've got two forces that are new to college football. One, I think, will aid in the goal that college football would attach itself to, which is to have that parity, and that's the transfer portal. And then the NIL, I have some concerns that it has the exact opposite effect.
How much will the transfer portal lessen the importance of your freshman recruiting classes that everybody just lives and dies with this? How many stars do they get, and where is our recruiting class ranked?
Well, that's a great question. I would say that if you just think literally your question, I would say it would lessen even nominally, because you do have a chance to make up for mistakes. Mm-hmm. But I still think it's still going to be your lifeblood, right? Because look at Washington, for example. They've lost guys to the portal. What's been the impact of their incoming transfers? You know, and maybe the Huskies will get better at targeting and whatnot with these guys. But, you know, I do want to say, in a topic that's related to this, I think fans, the average fan, kind of laments and decries the modern athlete, that, oh, he's going to, you know, they don't have the stomach to handle adversity. They're just going to bounce. Well, guess what? It's a two-way street. And if you're going to decry and you're going to criticize the student athletes, then also look what's happening on the coaching end. Because the coaches are saying, well, hey, I can just dabble in and go get a guy to play. For example, when I was backing up Steve Pelure, and I was behind Pelure, I knew that there was no option. I was going to have to beat out Chris Chandler, Paul Sicuro, and that's it. That's all. But I also didn't think that there was going to be a grad transfer coming in or some type of transfer coming in who's a three-year starter
right.
in the ACC.
Yep.
And so Don James would say to his staff, hey, look, every 2 or 3 years, we're going to have to start a new quarterback who has next to no experience, so we better recruit them and we better develop them because that's the situation we're going to be in. And so coaches are pulling the parachute on this and jumping into the portal just the same way. So that's my only message would be, if you're a fan who's disgusted by the athletes in the portal, take a good look at how the coaches are using the portal as well.
Yeah, I think we're getting further and further away from people being disgusted by anything in college football because it's all happening, and there's nothing you can do to stop any of it. Hey, John Donovan's on hold. Line one wants to talk to you off the air, so go ahead and pick him up. All right, man, great stuff.
Thanks, man.
We'll talk in a week. See you, pal.
Okay, enjoy, guys.
Hugh Millen, good stuff out of him. We'll get a break. We got a little DPI. Now, let me ask you this. Have you been officially bumped as the moderator of the Dixon Percentage Index?
On permanent vacation.
Wow.
Permanent vacation.
You have been bumped by an 8-year-old girl?
9-year-old girl.
9-year-old girl. All right. Well, we'll get to that. The DPI. You want to gamble on the game on Sunday. You want the money line. You want to know who's going to win this bad boy. Never mind our take. Never mind Dick's take. How about the idea from an 8-year-old, a 9-year-old kid, and an 11-year-old kid, who usually are pretty right, by the way. We'll do that. A little Stats Are for Losers, and then Tony Castricone coming up at 6:05 right here on 950 KJR.